This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Last week, I sent out by podcast a pathetic audio press conference from a New York City symposium. I called it Poison Flag. Two U.S. sailors tell their stories of being soaked with radioactivity aboard the aircraft carrier USS Ronald Reagan during the Fukushima nuclear accident in Japan. The sailors tell a harrowing tale of being exposed to radiation blowing from Fukushima over a period of 2 months as close as 1 mile from shore. They were not told of the accident until weeks later, were never properly tested for exposure, received no preventative treatment, and even now get no medical help from the Navy. Allegedly forced to sign waivers releasing the Navy from any responsibility, the pair are among more than 100 American sailors suing TEPCO, the Japanese nuclear plant operator. If you missed that, find it on the Radio EcoShock website at ecoshock.org. Click on Past Programs, and you'll see this special news audio available to you as a free MP3 download. This week, we'll hear straight from the conference The Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Accident. It was held at the New York Academy of Medicine March 11th and 12th. My thanks to the Helen Caldicott Foundation and Physicians for Social Responsibility for getting out the truth about Fukushima and about the ongoing impact of the nuclear plant explosion at Chernobyl. We'll hear scientists and activists explode the myths behind the catastrophe of March 11th, 2011, at the TEPCO Fukushima Daiichi nuclear complex. You'll hear about the unreported higher impact on women, children, and babies from Mary Olson, about disappearing wildlife at Fukushima and Chernobyl from Dr. Timothy Mousseau, professor of biological sciences at the University of South Carolina, Arnie Gunderson from Fair Winds, David Lockbaum from Union of Concerned Scientists Speak Up, and everything you wanted to know about cesium but were afraid to ask from Dr. Stephen Starr, University of Missouri. Let's get to our deadly myths of Fukushima. Myth number one, the accident is over. This is a huge lie politicians and power companies most desperately want you to believe. Here is Akio Matsumura, founder of the Global Forum of Spiritual and Parliamentary Leaders. Who is he? Let's just say Mr. Matsumura meets with world leaders one-on-one. As he tells us, when he was invited to dinner with the Japanese prime minister, the whole cabinet was invited to join them. And what did he tell them?
What I learned, this is an enormous challenge, are two invisible matters. So therefore, public people do not realize. Invisible matter, two. One is the children issue. So when I was invited to dinner by Prime Minister Hatoyama, he invited the cabinet member and the other senior member. And one of the cabinet member asked me, well, it's accurate. Helen said 1 million children affected Chernobyl or not. I said, it doesn't matter whether it's 1 million or 500,000, it doesn't matter. I said, it is a fact, as Helen said. It's already children radiation issue. And TEPCO said 50 years they may take to contain radiation. So this is a fact. So Hatoyama said, oh, is this fact of today? I said, yes, this is a fact of today. Don't go into argument, scientific argument. Whether this is a percentage risk for children or not, I believe in Helen. This is already, as of today, risk to the children. So, number one. Number two, invisible matter, is we do not know what happening now in the underground of the nuclear reactor. And he explained, when I talked to member parliament in Europe, my friend, they were under impression that already Fukushima issue was solved. And when I talked to your leader as well, they surprised to hear what I'm saying to what Bob Alvarez said, what Annie Gunderson said. They're surprised. So I'd like to let you know that we are challenging two invisible matters. The one I believe in Helen said, it is a fact of already as of today. Japan cannot escape from the reality that this radiation and children issue another 100 years or 200 years. Number two, this reactor issue. You cannot see the inside issue, so nobody knows. That's why people try to pay attention to policy issue. They forgot it's a potential accident remain now. You are talking policy matter 30 years, 40 years. You have a time, but Fukushima doesn't have a time. That's why I told to all party leaders, and I said one of the cabinet, my answer is to solve this issue, or to improve this issue, is maybe we might depend on military who assure their sacrifice, as Chernobyl did it. The many military workers died, which keep quiet and silence. But that is a reality. So these are issues I want to let you know.
Kevin Camp, radioactive waste specialist for the nonprofit group Beyond Nuclear, demolished the "it's over" myth when interviewed by Dr. Carl Grossman, chief investigative reporter for VVW Hamptons TV.
The sort of myth is that Fukushima happened, it's past, and the consequences are not catastrophic. What's the situation at Fukushima, Kevin?
Well, actually, the catastrophe is still unfolding. There's still radioactive releases from the site on an ongoing basis. There's leaks, especially from the water cooling systems that are leaking into the ocean. The radioactive fallout onto the mountainsides and onto the surrounding countryside are washing into the ocean from natural precipitation. The groundwater is actually leaching radioactivity from the site into the ocean. And it's worse than that, actually. There have been exposés of the so-called cleanup practices of the surrounding regions, the surrounding prefectures, where cleanup crews who are being paid handsomely to do this work are simply dumping radioactively contaminated materials into rivers to be washed out to sea. Of course, some of that's going to settle in the sediments of the rivers, in the fish that people may be eating. There's another tragic development in Japan where radioactively contaminated rubble is being incinerated all over the country, and there are not filters in place to catch the radioactivity before it is re-emitted into the atmosphere. So this accident, this disaster, this catastrophe, just like at Chernobyl, is ongoing when you're talking about half-lives of cesium-137 and strontium-90 of 30 years. You got to multiply by at least 10. That's 300 years of hazard associated with just those two radioactive poisons. So it's ongoing. Of course, we're not out of the woods yet either. What has happened has been catastrophic for Japan, for the world. But we are looking at a house of cards at Fukushima Daiichi Unit 4. It was damaged by the earthquake, by the tsunami, by a massive explosion. And that building is listing. There are bulges in the walls. There are 135 tons of high-level radioactive waste in that storage pool. And if that building collapses in another large earthquake, 7.0 is given as something to worry about. A worrying thing is when the Japanese minister visited the site many months ago, he said that this building is solid, it's strong, it could survive a 6.0 earthquake. People aren't talking about a 6.0. What if another big earthquake hits that site and the building collapses and the cooling water supply is lost? That 135 tons of high-level radioactive waste could catch on fire in a short period of time. There's no radiological containment over it. In fact, it's open air at this point. That radioactive release would dwarf what's happened thus far, because that's a lot of high-level radioactive waste. As much as 100% of the radioactive cesium-137 could escape in that fire. We're talking about an order of magnitude larger release of radioactivity than what's already occurred thus far in the last 2 years.
Find a link to all the symposium interviews by Carl Grossman at nuclearfreeplanet.org or in my show blog at ecoshock.info. In just one of 1,000 examples that the Fukushima accident is far from over, just listen to Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds.com in that morning Q&A session on March 11th at the symposium.
Groundwater is coming up through cracks in the building, and to the tune of 400 cubic meters a day, about 400 tons a day of water is introduced into the buildings where the nuclear fuel is lying on the floor. So we are getting highly contaminated water to the tune of 400 tons a day every day. Now, the Japanese are building tanks, and they're building a tank every 2.5 days to store this, about 1,000 tons per tank. There's a large tank farm where they're sucking water out of these basements and putting it into tanks that are not seismically qualified. I also was working with Dr. Koichi Nakamura early on in the accident, and both he and I felt that if you put a zeolite trench around the reactor, zeolite's a volcanic material that absorbs cesium, if you surrounded the reactors with a zeolite trench, it would be about 60 or 70 feet deep, about 20 meters deep, about 2 meters wide, 6 feet wide, and you pulled down the groundwater. If you sucked the groundwater out before it got into the reactor, you could avoid this problem. And Japanese officials who Dr. Nakamura and I were working with said, TEPCO can't afford it. So the ocean will continue to be contaminated. Please pray there's no earthquake, because the tank farm of hundreds of these tanks is not seismically qualified.
This is Radio EcoShock. It's a special Dangerous Myths of Fukushima. Myth number two, American reactors are safer. You think so? Think the next nuclear meltdown isn't just waiting for the USA? Here are two quick clips from David Lochbaum, nuclear engineer from the Union of Concerned Scientists, again from that morning Q&A session.
Okay. For David Lochbaum, two questions. How can the UCS claim that nuclear power can be safely operated when the history of the AEC, NRC, and industry show 60 years of dishonesty and negligence, not to mention the unsolved problem of nuclear waste? And the second question, David, is the implications of the Fukushima catastrophe are global. Would the Union of Concerned Scientists convene an inquest now that more information is available relating to this proven preventable tragedy?
Well, I'll take the second one first because it's easy. We thought about what we could do more, but when, in this country, we're having difficulty winning no-brainers with the federal government. For example, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, for the record, says that the risk from spent fuel in pools is the same as in dry casks. That's not, you couldn't even, that's so far from the truth, you couldn't see the truth from the Hubble telescope. And yet they maintain that's their official position. The federal government doesn't believe that we need to put filters in containment vents. The rest of the world, except for Spain, India, and us, has done so. We determined it's not necessary to do so, it looks like. So when you lose the no-brainers, it's difficult to move to a more altruistic or more idealistic point. Right now, the deck is stacked against the American public on the federal level. It's not really a chance. You know, they can't even get a budget except to pay themselves. So it's very difficult to think that they could look beyond that into helping us. As far as the first one, we do believe that nuclear power plants can be operated safely. The first major report I did for the Union of Concerned Scientists was called The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. The plants that were in the good column, we rated 10 plants in the United States on a safety scorecard we developed. The top-performing plant was the Surry plant in Virginia, that was also the lowest-cost electricity producer amongst the nuclear fleet. We first checked our math, because that wasn't what we thought the outcome was going to be. That's the reason we picked Surry. We thought they were taking shortcuts. They weren't. They were very aggressively looking for safety problems, not only at their own facilities but at others, and they coupled that with a very effective way of dealing with safety problems right the first time. In doing that, they were able to achieve good safety performance and good economic performance, which makes it harder to explain the plants in the ugly column that weren't doing either. They weren't economical and they weren't safe. To us, the role is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to not give owners the choice of being good or ugly, only good. But we don't have that in the United States. We have Sergeant Schultz on a national level. We have discussed, even before Fukushima, whether we should just say that we're run out of time. After 40 years of UCS looking on nuclear safety issues, that idealistic world where the NRC actually enforces safety regulations and the federal government actually gives a damn about the American public, maybe it's time to give up on that dream and throw in a towel and say these plants can't be operated. We haven't been able to reach that conclusion. We still fight the fight.
Now, here's one that it's for Lochbaum and Gunderson. Both California's nuclear plants are located, like Fukushima, in earthquake and tsunami zones. What are your recommendations for California in the light of Fukushima? And I will tell you ahead of time, you're not allowed to say, just leave.
Both the California plants are located on earthquake zones, and there are also two plants, four reactors. I had trouble with oceans earlier. None of the reactors in California meet the NRC's fire protection regulations. The Fukushima, one of the things that earthquakes can do is start fires because they can break up pipes carrying flammable liquids, hydrogen gas, and so on. It would be nice if California's regulated reactors actually met the fire protection regulations. After all, they were only adopted back in 1980, so they've had quite a few years to try to get into compliance. But the Nuclear Regulatory Commission gave each of the reactors in California more time to not be in compliance with fire protection regulations. So the Californians are protected today as well as the Japanese were on March 10th, 2011. They're protected against a reactor accident unless a reactor accident occurs. So I wouldn't buy lottery tickets in California because I think you've got better uses for your luck than trying to win a lottery, because you're in the nuclear lottery whether you like it or not.
Well, that's very encouraging.
You didn't let me answer the other one. Just leave.
That was David Lochbaum from the Union of Concerned Scientists. Myth number three, women and children are being protected. This is one of the most important lessons of this symposium. A stream of scientists and investigators have found women, girls, and babies in that order are far more sensitive to radiation than the 30-year-old healthy male used to set the acceptable radiation standards around the world. If you aren't outraged about what you are about to hear, you aren't paying attention. Here are clips from a presentation by Mary Olson. She's from the Nuclear Information and Resource Service of the Southeast Branch. She spoke on gender matters in the atomic age.
But I do want to just acknowledge that this level of radiation exposure is the same one that we call 2 REMS in the United States, that is the limit for atomic workers, and also the amount of radiation that the Japanese officials have said it's okay for school children to get while they're in school in the contaminated areas of Japan. Not even the amount that they're getting total at home and going back and forth and playing outside, just the amount that they would get while they're in school. So it's called low dose. In my book, it's not very low. So that graph tells us something. It tells us that one rad does not fit all. We've known for a long time that primary germ cells in the embryo are far more vulnerable. We heard about that today. The fetus, children, their cells are dividing much more rapidly. Their bodies are smaller. Alice Stewart taught us that elders have a bump up in their vulnerability as well. Their repair mechanisms maybe aren't working as much. Some genotypes. We have a whole oncology field that's now tied to what is your DNA. And we know that some people are more likely to get radiologically caused cancers. And now we have to add to that list a gender difference, that females, both juvenile and adult, are more sensitive. So it matters who gets the radiation, not just how long, not just how much, not just what kind. And ultimately, I think this does raise the question of what do we mean by dose? It's not a folk song. EPA standards say there's no safe dose. NRC bases Part 20 and ALARA on no safe dose. NAS reports from Beer 1 through 7 affirm no safe dose. And most of all, we've seen the data. We've seen it. So if we start with a standard man, first the medical community was protecting itself. Then the health physicist, who was Carl Morgan standing here 12 years ago, who said, we are all health physicists if we are concerned about radiation. They were sending military and paramilitary into very defined places in the Manhattan Project, into radiological zones that were small. Those standards were written for that purpose, and now they are being generalized to everybody, everywhere, all the time. And I need to draw to your attention not that upper circle that looks so fascinating, the lower circle. The lower circle is where we see that in 100 years, we have increased the radiological experience of our species by 25%. 100 years ago, we didn't have industrial nuclear facilities. So that's why I can say that. 25%. Think of other environmental parameters going up like that. Now, I'm not saying that this represents reality. It's total fiction as to who's getting what. But still, collectively, our institutions are telling us that we've done that. Here is the picture of how it travels through our environment, and it's an honest picture because it shows the man, the standard man. And I just am bringing Rosalie in because it was about 4 years ago that I started getting questions in my public talks about radiation impacting women disproportionately. And I called Rosalie because I couldn't find anything about this, and I was kind of embarrassed. I was 18 years into this work, and I'd never heard this, and where did it come from? And it was Rosalie who said, well, look at this. Well, that was out of print. I called her back. She said, go into Beer 7. It's not in the text. You'll have to look at the numbers. It's in the numbers. And so I did my own independent analysis of the famous report. And I think Steve Wynn gave us very strong cautionary words today that this report is based largely on the Hiroshima Nagasaki A-bomb survivors. It's largely that lifespan study that he says is deficient in so many ways. It calls to question many things. But I want to point out is we're not talking only about breast cancer. When I talk about women and cancer, everybody assumes I'm talking about breast cancer. It includes breast cancer, but it is the full range of cancers in which these tables show this result. So real people, my son, my sweetheart, me, a little girl who's gone, and her friend, two guys, three girls, that's the ratio overall. Two guys get cancer, three girls. Two guys die of cancer, three girls. So why isn't it in the text of the report? Maybe it doesn't come up statistically? Well, Arjun Makajani says it does. Maybe there weren't enough women involved. I don't know. But the generalizations about radiation are based on men. And when we take those assumptions solely, we have an underestimate of harm for women. And in the Nuclear Regulatory Commission regulations, that's about a 40% at least underestimation for the harm to women. And that means an overall underestimation of radiation harm since we're about half the population. So it could be dismissed. It could be just, oh, well, we forgot about it. But we are talking about every single female on the planet and every source of ionizing radiation from what I can tell because we really haven't looked. So why not cast the net that big? We need to look. And, by the way, there are now beginning to be animal studies in which these findings are also supported. So I need to wrap up, but I want to mention that the first big agency to put out a real sort of, yeah, okay, females are more affected is this recent report from the World Health Organization. I think it's a deeply flawed report. I don't have time to critique it other than to point out the icons. The first icon below the words is clearly an earthquake. The next icon is clearly a tsunami. And the third icon is clearly a pressurized water reactor that was not at Fukushima. So take that as a sign that you cannot apply what is in this report to necessarily reflecting reality. But it's an important moment where the World Health Organization is saying that there is a difference between males and females. They're saying 70% higher risk of thyroid cancer for little girls exposed below the age of five in that 0 to 5 age group. So quickly, ionizing radiation comes from outside our body. I believe there's a huge difference when it comes inside our body, and the Beer 7 report only looks at external. This book, which we've been all talking about, Alexei Yablokov has been with us, does factor internal exposure. There's this famous picture showing that radiation goes to different parts of our body, but the real point I want to make is that once it's in there, there's zero distance to the point of exposure, so the doses are extremely high. And the other thing is that external beta goes in about a centimeter. External alpha bounces off. There's zero exposure. And so the difference between an alpha particle in the body and not in the body is basically infinite. But when they compare it to an X-ray, It's anywhere from 7 times more damaging to findings that are 1,000 times more damaging. So if you're inhaling and ingesting radioactivity, if there's alpha particles present, they're really not reflected in the BIR-7 report. So that's another piece that we need to factor in here. Okay, wrapping up, I want to just go to this last slide. Disproportionate harm from ionizing radiation to females raises many issues. All are worthy of engagement. There's medical questions, there's ethical questions, there's historical, occupational, political, legal, evolutionary, and policy and regulation. It's my belief that we need to protect first and study second, but when it comes to the study, there are a bunch of places we could start. Probably not with body mass, because 0 to 5 age group, boys and girls are about the same. But Rosalie thought maybe it's the percentage of reproductive tissue. Someone else said maybe it's the proportion of fatty tissue. Maybe there are metabolic differences. Maybe it's selection, which is long-term environmental. Maybe it's lifestyle, which is short-term environmental. Hard to factor that last one with the 0 to 5 age group, though. And then finally, there are animal studies that are supporting this. So protect first, study second, but as we study, this is an important question, and I do not know of any major program addressing it. Thank you.
That was Mary Olson from NIRS. Look them up at nirs.org. That's from the symposium, The Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Accident, in New York City, March 11th and 12th.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Myth number 4, Japan will return to normal. We know this major nuclear accident is far from over. Now it's time to look at every aspect with Stephen Starr, Senior Scientist, Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Clinical Laboratory Science Program Director at the University of Missouri. This talk, March 11th, is titled, The Implications of the Massive Contamination of Japan with Radioactive Cesium.
This session is titled, The Medical and Ecological Consequences of Fukushima. The first speaker is Stephen Starr, from the Clinical Laboratory Science Program at the University of Missouri, and he is speaking about the implications of massive radiation contamination of Japan with radioactive cesium. Stephen.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here today. A large number of highly radioactive isotopes released by the destruction of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant grossly contaminated the Japanese mainland. Most of these radionuclides had short half-lives, which meant they would essentially disappear in a matter of days or months. For many of those who were exposed to them, there will be major health consequences. However, there are some radioactive elements that will not rapidly disappear, and it is these long-lived radionuclides that will remain to negatively affect the health of all complex life forms that are exposed to them. Chief among them is cesium-137, which has taken on special significance because it's proven to be the most abundant of the long-lived radionuclides that has remained in the environment following the nuclear disasters at Chernobyl and Fukushima. It has a 30-year radioactive half-life, which is why it persists in the environment.
We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock.